Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. The list of Democratic members of Congress planning to boycott the inauguration on Friday is now up to 40, according to a count by the Washington Post. That's up from 18 when we mentioned the boycott on yesterday morning show. We'll talk later this hour to two of the New York City members planning not to attend, Congressmembers Gerald Nadler of Brooklyn and Manhattan and Yvette Clark from Brooklyn. Much of the increase in the last day has come in response to the back and forth between Trump and Georgia Congressman and civil rights icon John Lewis. Lewis said he's boycotting the inauguration, an inauguration for the first time in his congressional career because of the interference by Russia making Trump an illegitimate president. But a Washington Post article from 2001 has come to light indicating that Lewis also boycotted the inauguration of George W. Bush, believing that he was not the true elected president after the Bush versus Gore Supreme Court debacle and Gore winning the popular vote then. The boycott by members of Congress is just one of many protests being planned for inauguration weekend, including the Women's March on Washington on Saturday, expected to draw at least tens of thousands of people. Definitely not boycotting the inauguration are some major donors and corporations who would like access to the new administration. The New York Times reports that corporations are opening the cash spigot for the inauguration, including some like UPS and JP Morgan Chase, that declined to fund the Republican convention despite past support because Trump had offended so many people and had become politically toxic. New York Times national political reporter Amy Chozick has her eye on both the inaugural and anti-inaugural events and has also been writing about Trump's possible immigration policies. Before the election, she covered the Clinton campaign. Thanks for coming on, Amy. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
I guess all members of Congress get inauguration tickets. Any indication how big the inauguration boycott might get among Democratic House members?
Well, as you mentioned, it's already at 40 plus and counting. And I think, you know, they're going to get a critical mass where more and more Democrats feel comfortable boycotting it. Of course, there's this dirty little secret that a lot of congressional members of Congress don't attend inaugurations sometimes. It's very cold out. That Congress isn't in session. They'd rather be home in their districts. So there's that to consider. But as you mentioned, a lot of these guys are from New York, so they could easily be in D.C. for an inauguration if they wanted to. And I think you saw with John Lewis that debate, and particularly with African-American members of Congress who believe that Republicans delegitimize Obama from the very beginning, you know, partly led by Trump's birther campaign. And so they see someone getting inaugurated who delegitimized the first African-American president, and now they have their own chance to protest his swearing in.
I don't remember, and I haven't seen references to the exact parallel thing, which would have been a lot of Republican House members boycotting the inauguration of Obama in 2009. Do you know?
Right. No, I don't believe that they did. And of course, that was a historically the crowds were historic at that inauguration.
There's approximately 200 Democrats in the House, so 40 out of about 200 boycotting so far, and we'll see if that grows or shrinks by Friday. Our local boycotters include Democratic House members Yvette Clark, who'll be on in a little while, Adriano Espaillat, Jose Serrano, Nydia Velasquez, and Gerald Nadler, who'll be on later in the hour. Also Bonnie Watson-Coleman from Northern New Jersey. I've been reading statements, Amy, by boycotting Democrats about their reasons, and they vary. Lewis cited the Russian hacking specifically. Others don't want to normalize Trump for all the things he said and done, like Congressman Brendan Boyle of Pennsylvania says it's because Trump is a unique threat to the Constitution and to our country. Congressman Don Beyer of Virginia released a statement that says, "I will not be part of normalizing or legitimizing a man whose election may well have depended on the malicious foreign interference of Russia's leaders, a person who lies profusely and without apology, who mimics the disabilities of others, who insults anyone who dares disagree with him, who would demonize an entire spiritual tradition, and who has demonstrated again and again a profound disrespect for women," that from Congressman Beyer. So it seems to me that people are following John Lewis's lead on a boycott more than they're following him to declare Trump's election illegitimate, would you say?
Right, exactly. There's no kind of unified call that the Russian interference made this election illegitimate. And it's worth pointing that Bill and Hillary Clinton will both be at the inauguration on the stage. And while she has blamed the Russian interference for the her loss, she has not called his election illegitimate. And she has not joined that choir.
Will she be there as the opposing nominee, or because all past presidents generally attend inauguration and so she's there as a spouse?
The latter. She will be there because all past presidents, everyone except George H.W., whose health isn't well, will be there.
Do you see that as a debate in Democratic Party circles right now? How much to not just criticize Trump for things he does, but also to declare him illegitimate because of the Russian hacks?
Absolutely. I mean, you saw President Obama in his farewell address in Chicago really say that we respect the peaceful transfer of power and we're respecting the democratic process. And he will, of course, meet with Donald Trump at the inauguration. But then there's another camp that says, there were three or four investigations into Benghazi and we need to be seriously investigating the Russian interference into the election and deciding how much. I mean, this is an election that was determined by 70,000 votes spread over three states, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin and Michigan. And so everything influenced it. And so there are Democrats who say, why aren't we crying out as loud as the Republicans were for something like Benghazi?
You covered the Clinton campaign mm-hmm. before the election. Are any Clinton people now trying to say that the outcome would actually have been different were it not for the Russian hacks?
Absolutely, they're saying it. And it is worth pointing out that before we knew as much as we know about the Russian hacks, they were saying the outcome would have been different because of James Comey releasing the letter about her emails. And so I think there was a lot of blame on various fronts, but they believe that the outcome would have been different.
I'm curious how they make that case, because certainly even an attempt by a foreign adversary to influence the election is objectionable. But do the Clinton folks cite any details of those emails released by WikiLeaks as having landed much with the public, anything that might have been specifically damaging?
What's interesting is the content was relatively innocuous. It was the trickle of news about emails. And I also think voters aren't paying as much attention as you and I are. And you just hear emails. And so you're conflating it with her private server. And it's just this swirl of sort of negativity. And her trust numbers, as you know, were already really bad. I often say to her former campaign aides, well, did the Russians, go into her Google Calendar and delete the Wisconsin rallies? There were things that she could have done.
The ones she didn't hold.
Exactly, the ones she didn't hold. So there were things certainly that the campaign could have done to reach out to those Rust Belt voters that they didn't do. And it's very hard to blame Russian interference on some of those problems.
Listeners, if you think the Podesta email hack and DNC email hack by Russia and released by WikiLeaks might have affected the actual outcome of the election, what was it from those emails that you think was damaging? Or was it more amorphous than the specific things that were leaked? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, as we talk to New York Times national political correspondent Amy Chozick. By the way, is Congressman Lewis correcting himself now? If he's come out yet on saying he never boycotted an inauguration before, does he say he forgot about 2001? Republicans are saying maybe he lied about this. Does he say the Washington Post story from back then is wrong and he actually did attend that inauguration of Bush? Do you know?
I don't know. Right before I walked in the studio, I saw that Donald Trump had tweeted that he lied and he attended. He also boycotted the Bush inauguration. And so we'll see if he has responded yet.
It is interesting that in both of the elections of the last two Republican presidents, the Democrat won the popular vote and there were questionable circumstances. Florida in 2001, right. Russia this year. In fairness, Bush won the election and the popular vote in his 2004 campaign. I saw that you were mentioned a few times in the Clinton emails. Sometimes
oh, no.
They liked your reporting. Sometimes they didn't. Did you learn anything from reading about yourself, about how they tried to manage the press?
Well, if anything, it sort of confirmed everything that we thought, that sort of everything that came out of her mouth was focus grouped and written by committee, every joke thought over. And they would often push back on that because it made her seem, insincere and inauthentic. But all of these emails sort of confirm what we thought, that there was this committee deciding there's a great exchange where they're deciding whether she should tell a joke. And it's just kind of this endless back and forth between a dozen aides of whether this joke will land. I was called some names in those emails, but I don't think it was too surprising. I think we're supposed to have a contentious relationship at times.
Let's take a phone call. Here is Alan in Brooklyn. Alan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Good morning, Brian. Welcome to the last week of normalcy. There are so many legal reasons that could be raised by a well-meaning and intelligent prosecutor or legislature why this could be called an illegitimate election. First of all, not only do we have an electoral college that's an anachronism, but it's one that artificially diminishes the voting power of all black citizens in America because most of them live in populous states. It's almost never mentioned with a simple fraction people could grasp in a moment what the fraction of voting power the average black citizen has in Senate and presidential races compared to white voters, given that they're packed now into populous states that are getting a diminished electoral college representation. So that alone, let's say that fraction is less than three-fifths of the white voter. That has a lot of symbolic historic resonance because the three-fifths compromise initially gave blacks three-fifths of personhood when they had no vote at all. Now that we give them the right to vote, how can we say they have less than three-fifths of a white vote in presidential and Senate races? And that's totally aside from the impact of the fraud involved in trying to exploit that white vote advantage by Trump deliberately lying about issue positions to rev up the vote count in those states, knowing that he wasn't going to keep those promises after the fact.
Alan, thank you very much. Is there any serious talk? I guess they would need people in both parties, maybe they would need people in a lot of states to bring about the kind of electoral reform that Alan suggests, like electoral college reform.
Well, certainly, and the caller is correct that I would say the way the Electoral College is drawn, not only do African-American voters have less power, but everyone who moves to cities, you know, young people who leave their homes are often tend to be more liberal. They move to cities. So a lot of millennials, people of color, recent immigrants, children of immigrants. And so there's definitely a thinking there. But I would just add that there, you know, turnout among black voters was down in North Carolina, down in Florida among Latinos and African-Americans. And so there was a sense that, you know, the Obama coalition that the Clinton campaign had hoped would turn out didn't turn out. And that's, I don't think, why she lost, but that certainly contributed to those razor-thin margins.
Mark in the West Village, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mark.
Yeah, hi. I believe that, you know, the reasons for Hillary Clinton's loss are certainly really multifaceted. But for anyone to suggest that the Russian intervention, by spreading this perception over a long period of time, they managed to portray her as corrupt, as dishonest, as untrustworthy. I think they were one of the main purveyors of that kind of fake perception. And most of the people who were not voting for Clinton, that's the first thing they would say was, I don't trust her. She's corrupt. Even though as a public official for, you know, as a, you know, public servant for 30 years and someone who's been investigated probably more than any other public servant, she's never been convicted of any crime, but they portrayed her as a criminal. And that's what people really believed.
Although for those WikiLeaks emails, the Podesta emails, I should say, released by WikiLeaks, starting on October 7th, that late in the campaign, to have had an impact, something would have had to land on people who did not already conclude that Clinton was untrustworthy, as a lot of the people who are going to vote for her, vote against her, had already concluded. Can you cite anything in those emails that you think might have landed out there?
Well, I think that, you know, the fact that they were just trying to portray her as a backbiter. They're showing the inner workings, the way the people actually speak to each other in a campaign. But, I mean, I think it was a much longer campaign to portray her as this dishonest person. And Trump referred to WikiLeaks as his source over and over, constantly.
He did. There's a count out there now, Amy. I don't know if you know the number. I don't remember the exact number, but I think it's over 100 times that Trump mentioned the WikiLeaks dump in the month of October.
Right, but now he says that had nothing to do with his victory. No, but the reader is correct, and I think it just – I think that she came off the third debate. You know, everyone agreed that she had such strong debate. She came off the third debate ahead. All of these sort of voters who maybe didn't like her but were really turned off by Trump, especially women, suburban women, were leaning to – breaking towards her. And so the campaign has analyzed, well, what happened between the third debate and the election? And you had the letter from Comey about her emails, and you had, you know, just this flood of Podesta emails, which frankly, some of them were his risotto recipe. It just all added to this swirl of distrust around her.
Craig in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Craig.
Hey, Brian. Thank you for taking my call. I appreciate it, and sure. I appreciate the speaker that's with you. Thank you. You know, I wanted to say that I think that Podesta emails and the Clinton emails, obviously, the majority of what we read was pretty damning information. But I don't think that's what had anything to do with why Hillary Clinton lost the election. And I think that the email, the WikiLeaks whole concept, as well as the Russian hacking, frankly, is more of a narrative that's being presented to us as an excuse for why she lost, when in reality, it seems to me the reason why she lost is because of the infrastructure of all of the different individual states' voting systems. And so we discovered that during the Bernie Sanders primary. We discovered that in the competition between Hillary as well as Trump. And we saw in the recount that Jill Stein attempted to make with Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, that there was a great deal of violation of the Voting Rights Act. And so we know that when they dismantled Article 5 in the Voting Rights Act, that made it possible for all of these individual Republican states and their state officials to challenge various things, like, in, let's say, in South Carolina, where these people were able to vote once a week on a Sunday because a lot of people like to vote on a Sunday. So they stopped that. Look at Pennsylvania. The Green Party candidate challenged in court the idea that they would not turn on ballot imaging devices that were put into Pennsylvania machines so that they could do a recount and compare the actual ballot image with the tabulation that came from the machine.
I hear you, Craig, and there were so many flashpoints and so many states where Republicans were pushing laws that made it harder to vote and Democrats were resisting or pushing laws that made it easier to vote. I think it was North Carolina where they took away Sunday voting in the early voting weeks. Do the Clinton folks now, after the fact, raise that, or are they primarily focused, if they're not just throwing up their hands at this point because there's nothing more they can do about it, on the Russian emails?
Well, I would say they were always concerned about voting rights. I mean, partly because this is a winning issue when you're trying to connect to black voters. But I think from the very beginning of her campaign, she was concerned about voting rights. And she was actually even proposing new measures to make it easier for people who are poor and people of color to vote. And so but I think they are. Hillary Clinton in particular has made the Russian hacks very personal. She said she had a very contentious relationship with Russia and Putin while she was Secretary of State. And this was because she called it a personal beef he had with me. And so she definitely that is what she is blaming the loss on right now, especially because of their contentious history.
It could be that the most influential of the hacks was not anything from the Podesta emails, which came out in October, but rather from the DNC system, the thing that came out in the summer that caused the resignation of Debbie Wasserman Schultz,
yeah,
right, as DNC chair, showing that the Democratic Party apparatus was working for Clinton against Sanders rather than staying neutral.
Yeah, I would say, I mean, the caller before mentioned this swirl of distrust, and I definitely think her numbers, her distrust numbers were high, but there was another element with it. She was part of the establishment in a year when people really wanted to shake things up. And I think when you saw those DNC emails, it's kind of confirmed a lot of people's belief that she is part of this big establishment that is undemocratic, that is part of a, you know, royal family almost, and that she was being anointed. And so that, you know, also added to those negatives. And I think it also hurt her when she tried to win over the Bernie wing of the party in a general election. They were very angry.
What's the difference between Clinton saying now that the Russian hacks influenced the outcome of the election and her not saying that Trump is an illegitimate president? If Trump, you know, was helped by a foreign power and wouldn't have won without the foreign power, John Lewis concludes that the election is therefore illegitimate. Clinton, it sounds like, is saying, yeah, he won because of the Russian interference, but she's not saying illegitimate. What's the distinction?
Right. I think that that's a really good point. And I think that she and her allies are putting it all out there and letting others, you know, draw that conclusion. They don't want that to come directly from their mouths. But I think there's another wing of the Democratic Party that is very concerned with all this blame of the Russians because, you know, people like Joe Biden have said, we're not really going to assess the real problem here, which was for some reason, Democratic messages have lost resonance among white working class Rust Belt voters who used to always vote Democratic. And are we going to continue to blame Comey and the Russians? Are we going to assess how our message could be more inclusive to include more white working class voters?
Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Amy Chozick, national political correspondent for The New York Times. Let me ask you about the Times article yesterday by your colleague Nicholas Fandos on all these corporations throwing big money at the inauguration. Chevron, $500,000. Boeing, which Trump has criticized for the cost of their government aircraft contracts, $1 million. I mentioned UPS and J.P. Morgan Chase before, which conspicuously stayed away from financing Trump's Republican convention when he was considered politically toxic. Now they're throwing money at the inauguration. What do companies get from these donations?
Well, we've seen with Donald Trump is a single tweet can impact a company's bottom line, and he is not shy about calling out individual corporations. I mean, something interesting about that story was this is going to be the most expensive inauguration in history, but in many ways it's also going to be incredibly scaled back. It's 3 days instead of four. Trump and Melania are going to three balls. Bill Clinton went to 14. Obama went to 12. And so while it's scaled back, it's also the most expensive. So it tells you sort of, even as Trump says this isn't about celebrities, it's about normal people, it's about the people who voted for me, it shows you that it's not just about those people. It's also about these incredibly wealthy special interests who feel like the kind of go-go days of access are back.
And the Fandos article says, in exchange, Mr. Trump's most prolific donors will gain access to what amounts to a parallel inauguration week, carefully planned and largely out of public sight, during which they can mingle with members of the incoming administration over intimate meals. And then he goes on to say, ethics experts say Mr. Trump's donors are being given greater access and facing fewer limits on donations than those in other recent inaugurations, despite his vow to, quote, drain the swamp of special interests in Washington. I guess laws don't cover limits on donations to things like inaugurals and conventions like they cover campaign donations.
Right, exactly. And even in campaign contributions, of course, there's Citizens United, where you can give to unlimited contributions to super PACs and outside groups.
All right. How about anti-inaugural events? How do you see the big march shaping up for Saturday?
Well, it's shaping up to be big. And of course, you can't just plan a simple march anymore. There's all these sort of dissent within this women's march about who is it really for and who is it representing and who is being excluded and why are they excluding different groups. And so it's been a really interesting sort of litmus test of where the feminist movement sees itself.
Is it really dissent or just they're figuring it out?
I think they're figuring it out. I mean, there have been my colleague Farrah Stockman had a great story about a white woman from South Carolina was coming to Washington for the march, and a Brooklyn blogger told her she better check her white privilege and that they needed to, you know, focus on women of color at this march because the real problems impact them. And so there's been some dissent there. And then just the other day, a women's group that opposes abortion rights wanted to be a part of the march, and the organizers, and this is kind of a loose consortium of organizers, said no. This is a pro-choice march.
Huh. That particular group opposes abortion rights, but also opposes Trump.
Exactly. Yes.
The march.
There is that Venn diagram of women.
There is some overlap.
Yes.
There. The march website's official mission page says, the rhetoric of the past election cycle has insulted, demonized, and threatened many of us, immigrants of all statuses, Muslims and those of diverse religious faiths, people who identify as LGBTQIA, Native people, Black and brown people, people with disabilities, survivors of sexual assault, and our communities are hurting and scared. The Women's March on Washington will send a bold message to our new government on their first day in office and to the world that women's rights are human rights. We stand together, recognizing that defending the most marginalized among us is defending all of us. So that language makes it sound like at once a march particularly for women's rights and at the same time for the rights of all those other groups of, you know, potentially threatened and marginalized people by a Trump administration.
Well, exactly. And I think that the term women's rights has really changed. I mean, initially, you think about it as access to abortion, birth control, but it's really including everything from gun control, which disproportionately impacts women, mothers who've lost children to gun violence, climate change, economic issues, kitchen table issues, all of these things the organizers say, you know, are women's issues. We have to stop thinking so narrowly.
Elizabeth on the Upper East Side will be attending some kind of protest, I think. Elizabeth, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Thank you. Yes, I work with Woven, which is We Oppose Violence Everywhere Now, which is a digital platform to bring together organizations, peace organizations around the world. And we are forming a peace circle. We've selected the corner of 96th Street and Lexington Avenue because there's a synagogue, a mosque, and a Catholic church there. And we are just going to, we need 750 people to just form a circle of peace, holding hands. It will be Thursday at 5:30. And there's not going to be any speeches or, it's just going to be a moment of peace.
So you're looking for 750 people to gather at 96th and Lex Thursday at 5:30 as kind of an interfaith circle of peace around those three religious institutions?
Yes, to just hold hands to show that we want a very peaceful world.
Elizabeth, thank you very much. And there will be marches in other cities, too, on Saturday, including New York, for people who can't or don't get to Washington.
Exactly. There's a march in New York that's supposed to start at the UN at the same time as the march in Washington. And they're happening all over the country.
You wrote an article the other day on immigration raids of workplaces during the Bush administration that sounded like much more than just the deportation of violent criminals that the Trump people say they're now going to emphasize. What were you looking back on?
Well, during the Bush years, particularly late in the Bush years after Bush couldn't accomplish immigration reform, they had to get their numbers of deportation up. And so there were these, it became known as these workplace raids. They'd storm into a meatpacking plant and round everyone up and deport them. And this was considered an inhumane practice by a lot of activists. It would split up families. It also targeted the immigrants who have been here a long time, what Michael Chertoff called the low-hanging fruit. They've been here a long time, and they go to work every day. And they often have wives who are working somewhere else or husbands who are working in the fields. And so they would split up families. And so Obama, of course, has deported a record number of people. He's been called the deporter in chief, but he has not done it. He's done it by auditing businesses that hire illegal immigrants, and he's cracked down on the border. But these raids sort of disappeared. And there's a lot of concern that for Donald Trump to get to this number of 2 to 3 million immigrants deported, he would have to reinstate these raids and effectively kind of redefine what a criminal is. Anyone working with forged papers is technically breaking the law.
And that was an interesting part of your article to me. You mentioned that Trump people have talked about broadening the definition of who is a criminal. If they say they're only going to deport criminals, at least in a first wave. So what might that look like? Who might be included as a criminal who's not now?
Well, the place that we saw this, the starkest example of this was in Arizona under show of Joe Arpaio, who said that anyone using forged documents was a criminal, that they were commit. And he would push back that this was about deportations, but it was about identity theft and using forged Social Security cards. And so could you apply that on a national scale of you're breaking the law, you're using a fake Social Security card to get this job at a meatpacking plant?
So it's hardly just violent criminals, which might be the impression that he left on the trail, talking about, you know, people who've been attacked in cities by undocumented immigrants, things like that.
Exactly.
Last thing, you also wrote recently about the Trump people seeking guidance on where a wall can actually be built along the Mexican border, right. But considering fencing in some places. Maybe this is a stupid question, but what's the difference between a wall and a fence in practical terms?
Well, there's already a lot of fencing around, and I'm actually from South Texas.
Uh-huh.
My family's in Laredo. Laredo, so I know the border pretty well. And there's actually already a lot of fencing around. I think the symbolism of the wall, you know, is something that really terrified border communities and also really galvanized Donald Trump's base. And so now he's saying it could be fencing, it could be some kind of electronic monitoring, which is not the same thing as a wall, even though it, you know, it seems to do the same purpose.
How high is the fence you're familiar with in South Texas? Do you know?
I mean, it varies. Along, you know, there's some national parks that split both sides of the border, and it's just like a little bit of fencing because you don't want to interrupt nature. And then there's like very high fencing with barbed wire at the top around ports like Laredo and busy areas.
Amy Chozick, national political correspondent for The New York Times, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up next, it's now three guests we're going to have. It started as one earlier this morning. Two others have joined. We're going to have three members of the New York City congressional delegation who will be boycotting the inauguration. We have Congressman Gerald Nadler, Congresswoman Yvette Clark, and Congressman Jose Serrano. Stay with us for the three.